The Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening and welcome to the Blackshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio. This evening in the studio with me, I've got Vicky Weston.
Hello.
And Alexander Pankhurst.
Hello.
And a very, very new voice on the podcast, it's Dave Turnbull.
Hello, thanks for having me.
That's okay, Dave. Do you want to give us a little, like, a one-liner about who you are, Dave?
I have very little to do with the arts world. I am a teacher of small children, but I am Vicky's fiancé, so that's my connection to Blackshaw.
I basically dragged him here under protest. Yeah.
But I did used to work in film as a sound engineer, and I have provided sounds for multiple shows for Blackshaw in the past.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you taught Andy Crane, didn't you?
Taught him everything he knows. That is correct.
He's got many
that claim right now.
He's got many a tie with Blackshaw Theatre. So this week on the show, we are going to be listening to some new Writing Night pieces. We're also going to be hearing from Matt Boothman, who is currently, as we speak, in Edinburgh.
Yep, fringing it up hard.
A roving reporter.
Yeah, he's roving around. I'm following him on Instagram, and every day he's seeing like 3 shows.
That's the way.
And every day I'm like, more? This is crazy.
I think next year we should do a group trip.
Yeah.
And do a radio show.
Oh, wow. Live from Edinburgh. Edinburgh.
Oh. Roadshow style.
Roadshow style, yes, correct.
That's a very good idea.
Yeah, and we could get some special guests in.
Oh, yeah.
That would be pretty good.
Oh, wow, yeah, that's a very good idea.
It's not a solid promise, but that is basically what we'll do next year.
Well, so that plan's made. We're going to be hearing from Matt a little bit later on in the show. Vicky's going to do an arts thing, but the first thing that we always do is this, but it's slightly different this week because obviously Matt's not here. So this is a retro movie review of Labyrinth. And I feel like, Vicky, you were there in the
room. I was there in the room. We were at my house. I think Dave was in the room as well.
I was, yeah.
And also we had a very special guest voice on our retro film review, which was, of course, Ellie Pitkin.
Yep. So this is all of those people you've just heard reviewing Labyrinth.
The Matt Boothman film review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
This is a retro movie review with Matt, Ellie and Vicky. Evening all.
Hello.
Evening.
And we've just finished watching the classic Labyrinth.
So classic. It was so classic.
It was Ellie's first time.
I know, right? You guys were not gentle with me. Yeah, I was amazed that you hadn't seen it, because it's so up your street.
I know, and I've probably seen sort of bits of songs and things.
Yeah.
And I knew the premise, but no, I'd never seen it.
So the premise is Jennifer Connelly is Sarah, who is 16 and doesn't want to babysit her baby brother, and so sells him to the goblins.
Because why not?
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't really... I don't think she really knows what she's doing.
No. Well, I don't think she expects it to work.
No. But she does. She does say she wants the goblins to take him away.
I mean, she literally has to say the words, "I wish the goblins would take you away."
Right now.
Yes. And she says that. So to then immediately regret it seems a little bit much, I think.
A little foolish.
Yeah. So Jareth the Goblin King, expertly played by David Bowie.
The late, great
David Bowie, turns up in owl form and takes, well, and then in David Bowie form, with super tight trousers, and then takes baby Toby away and says,
"You've got 13 hours to get to the middle of my labyrinth and get him back, or he turns into a goblin."
Ba-ba-bum!
Lots of beautifully painted labyrinthy backgrounds.
Yep. And some terrible blue screen.
Yep, and some nice polystyrene sets.
Yeah. Yep.
And
some sweet Jim Henson puppets.
I was going to say, some fantastic Jim Henson
so good.
Creatures.
That's why I think I was so surprised I hadn't seen it, because I'm a big Henson fan.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's so... And it's got the... It's whimsical, and it's wacky, and it's funny, and a lot of it doesn't really make any sense, but it's brilliant anyway. And
The plot's pretty straightforward. She tries to get to the middle of the labyrinth. Sometimes she has setbacks. People she meets along the way double-cross her sometimes.
I've noticed that every time I haven't seen it for a long time, but it was probably the third or fourth time I've seen it. And I've noticed that every time somebody says, "Oh, it's a piece of cake," then something terrible happens.
Yeah.
Every single time.
Yeah. I think we're going to make it.
Something terrible happens. And there are loads of really good, terrible challenges that are much worse than your average labyrinth. I think my favourite is the Bog of Eternal Stench.
Yeah, I remember that. That made an impression on me. I think the very first time I saw the movie, quite young. Obviously, I was quite young. I didn't remember a huge amount of it. But the Bog of Eternal Stench definitely left its mark.
Yeah. I think
there's a lot of fart jokes.
Yeah, so many. It's so gross. And
they're
hilarious.
Not even fart jokes, it's just fart noises.
Yeah. Just noises. Yeah, no one's even making jokes about it. Everyone's just going, "Oh, it smells so bad." It's so good. So, yes, she goes on her journey to the centre of the labyrinth and then has a kind of final showdown, as you would expect. I feel like none of these are spoilers.
No, it's kind of... It's a formulaic structure. But because you meet so many weird and wonderful characters along the way, that's what the kind of engage point is, I think.
Yeah.
Having seen it for the first time, you know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know the flow it's going to take, really. I wasn't surprised by anything that happened.
No.
The surprises and the intrigue comes from the characters and what they say.
Yeah, definitely. And there's some really good, like, it's super funny. There are some really super funny characters. And I think it is a real, like, it's a real laugh-along. For people that know it really well, it's a real quote-along movie. And it has that real, like, cult status that, you know, has people mostly dressing up as Jareth the Goblin King on a regular basis.
I feel like a lot of the other characters would be pretty difficult to pull off as costumes.
You'd have to be in a suit, wouldn't you?
That's some sort of latex masks.
Yeah. But his trousers, I mean, can we just, for a second...
Yeah, let's discuss
it. I would say let's focus on that, but that is pretty much all I focused on whenever he was on screen.
Yeah.
They are inappropriately tight.
Yeah. I mean, is this a film for children? I don't know.
Presumably kids just they do not notice
maybe
that.
Maybe they don't notice.
All.
I feel like I didn't notice it in the first couple of viewings, but the last two times I've seen it, that has been the main topic of conversation.
I don't know that I looked at David Bowie's face at all.
No, you're just like...
Oh, no, we definitely commented on his hair.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there's some shots where all you can see is above the waist.
Yes. And then it's easy not to think about the trousers. That's true.
Yeah. But I don't think they would pass muster under standards for sort of child-friendly films.
No.
Because I remember hearing an interview with you know, the new Cinderella live action.
Oh yeah.
Version
I've seen it.
Yeah. And I can't remember his name. Who plays the prince?
Richard Madden.
Thank you. He was talking about how the trousers were an issue. And they went through several different types of trousers, and for some of them he had to actually not wear them on medical grounds because they would cut off the blood supply.
Holy mother!
But regardless of that, when they did choose the super tight trousers that he did wear in the film, they still like didn't really do any shots where you could actually see the crotch area
because it was
obscene. So it was like him being a pregnant lady in a
series. Oh, well, they have to have like handbags and things.
Yeah, so he always had like conveniently placed items.
They should just got him different trousers.
Give him a cod piece or something.
Were people at that time? I don't even know what time period we're talking about here for Cinderella.
I don't know.
I don't know. But at that time, were people seriously walking around with giant bulges in their trousers?
I don't know.
That were like well defined trouser bulges. Anyway, this has become very inappropriate. But if you see that film, if you see Labyrinth, it will be noticeable. What I love about it is that David Bowie's face is everywhere in it. Like, it's embedded
in the scenery.
There's some really clever stuff with, like, forced perspective and things like that where they have his face everywhere. And it's just, like, the creativity that it took to bring that all to life just is fantastic.
And I think the details like that are one of the many reasons that it's had such a lasting appeal.
Yeah, absolutely.
People still do go back to it over and over again and watch it over and over again. Because there are so many background details you miss. Details like that, where his face will be painted into the back of one of the labyrinth backgrounds.
Yeah.
But also things like that all the... a lot of the labyrinth details and characters that Sarah meets are referenced in her bedroom earlier in the movie, which you can't really tell on the first viewing. You've really got to...
Yeah, because you're not looking for it.
So you have to go through repeat viewings for that stuff to get the value out of it.
I think all of the major things she encounters are all in the room, aren't they? Even like the dress she's wearing. And I think in one of the pictures of her mum that's in the scrapbook, David Bowie's in the picture with her. So it's like everything's got this like reference point where they've drawn on her.
Yeah, because
her
the
fantasy.
Whole thing is it's her working through things. It's all you can read it on a level of magic, or it's a big metaphor about her learning responsibility and learning not to take things for granted. We were saying it as
at the beginning.
It,
yes,
it's a, hammered home a little bit in places.
Yeah, there's a lot of like, in the labyrinth, don't take everything for granted. Don't take things for granted. Don't take things for granted. And it's like, yeah, okay, I think she gets the picture now.
But exactly as you say, Ellie, like, that stuff is such a small part of the movie, really. It's what's driving everything forward, but that's not where sort of the principal enjoyment of it comes, I don't think.
No, no, and certainly not for, on like a rewatch basis. Like, you're not watching it to see this woman go through this, you know, transformation of child into adult. It's you're watching it because the characters are brilliant, like, and hilarious.
I think going back to the sets, like I thought they were really theatrical.
They
in
are
the way
yeah,
that
yeah.
they're constructed, because they're not realistic. It's a fantasy world, and it's not even trying to be realistic in that rocks don't look like rocks. Really, they do look like balls of polystyrene that've been painted. And I kind of like that make do and mend scrapbook aesthetic that runs throughout. It makes it much more fun to watch, and it's more like it's coming from the pages of a book rather than a big like Hollywood blockbuster style.
Yeah, I have the feeling that if that film got made today, that is what would they would do something that would be like really high budget, and it would just be like, actually it's her, it's a, you know, if it's supposed to be her imagination or it's drawing on her own imagination, then it should look kind of like children made it. Like,
yeah,
kind of makes sense.
That's what gives it its soul, I think.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Yeah, it's got a, like, there's lots of nice, like, whimsical things or things that feel, handmade or slightly improvised, or, you know, it's, that's where the joy comes from watching films that are like that, I think.
I was about to say, if it was made today, it would probably be very heavily CG, and was about to sort of be a bit disparaging about that. But then, that's what they've done with The Jungle Book this year.
Yeah.
And that seems to have gone down really well, and they seem to have actually, maybe CG's got to the point where you can actually pull that off.
I mean,
and it seems sort of photorealistic enough that you don't get that problem with CG where it just doesn't seem real and nothing seems to matter.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, yeah, I think that's the thing now, that CGI has gone so far that actually you can't, that it's almost seem like it's seamless to be able to tell the difference between what's real and what's imagined.
Yeah.
But, I think in this, like, for something that's supposed to be magical and in her imagination, or in someone's imagination, having something that does look like it's not quite there is probably a good thing.
I feel like if they did a sort of top of the range CGI remake of Labyrinth, they would probably still make it in the same style that it is. So they'd end up making a CGI rock that looks like it's made out of polystyrene painted.
Yeah.
Because they wouldn't want to make it look like a real rock, because that's kind of, like you say, it's not thematically the point, is it?
Yeah. I just like that about it, that it's just got this kind of whole, like, you can imagine, like, it's like her imagination. If you are the, you know, if you were the kind of child, the kind of teenager that had a really active imagination and was doing those kinds of things, like, you could kind of imagine making up this world that, you know, is your way of dealing with the process of becoming a grown-up, and that's quite a nice... We've done films before about, film reviews before about this process. This is what Spirited Away
course,
is about, this same thing, although Chihiro is a younger protagonist, but hers is about moving house and going to a new school.
Yeah,
it's but it's fundamentally
about,
the same.
That one's much less about her being bratty at the beginning and, and sort of learning to grow out of that.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas this is like, she's pretty heinous at the, Sarah in Labyrinth is pretty heinous at the beginning. Like, she has a massive strop.
Like, everything leading up to her actually summoning the goblins to take her brother away is like, she's not very likable.
No, she's 100% unacceptable behaviour. I'd be like, young lady, you are grounded. This is outrageous. Yeah, she's like, this, my life is so awful. It's like, you live in a really nice house in like somewhere in rural America. Like, just be okay about this. But you know, she is by the end.
And that's the whole
point. And that's the point.
What everything is trying to teach her is, actually, you've got things pretty good. Don't take your nice life or your family for granted.
Yeah. And on that note, thank you very much, everybody.
Okay.
So that was Vicky, Dave, Ellie, and Matt, all talking about Labyrinth.
I think Dave might have been in the room but not saying anything.
Oh, Dave didn't say anything. Just like
silent,
he's not...
silent Dave. That's my usual style.
Yeah. Apart from today.
Yeah. So Labyrinth is one of my favourite movies ever, but Ellie was saying in this that she'd never seen it before.
That is correct. This was her first viewing, which we found surprising because it's so up her street. Like, it's got all the parts that you would imagine in a film that Ellie would enjoy.
She enjoyed it.
She loved it.
Yeah. How could you not enjoy that film?
It's such a good film. It's a classic. And if you haven't seen it, then I fully recommend you get hold of it. You can probably get it on DVD for like £2.
It's a great Sunday afternoon film.
It's so good.
Good music. David Bowie looking banging.
Yeah.
You can't ask for anything more.
Making a baby chuckle. It's hilarious.
Throwing it around.
Throwing that baby around. I mean, on paper, doesn't sound like a good film. I'm going to put it out there. But it is good. It is very good.
Well, if you're listening to the show, last show, then we were talking about Suicide Squad with Matt. And that movie hasn't really gone down particularly well. And Matt didn't particularly like it that much. But the arts thing that Vicky, you're going to talk to us about today is sort of surrounding what we were talking about last week, which was around method acting.
That's correct. We had a collective conversation off air about the fact that a lot of the press coverage that we were seeing and a lot of the interviews with Jared Leto seemed to focus on his role as the Joker and his method acting. I mean, it could be a personal thing, but I think a lot of people who work in theatre feel the same way that I do, which is that method acting is one of those kind of things that's like a bit of a cross that the acting world has had to bear, because so much of the press coverage about a film suddenly focuses on that one actor who's being method. Mm. I do the air quotes, but you know, we're on the radio. And it's one of those things where it becomes the complete central focus of everything that the film is about. And I think it's does a disservice to the actors who haven't needed to go method to be able to achieve exactly the same result. And the Joker's a famous character Jack Nicholson famously, when he played the Joker incredibly well, famously said that he felt like the Joker had like got into his head. And obviously Heath Ledger had a similar experience, which a lot of people have been kind of connected to then his unfortunate early death. And I think that Jared Leto kind of maybe got a bit swept up in the kind of mythology around the Joker as a character. Mm-hmm. And felt like if he didn't say he'd gone a bit mad playing the Joker, that he would somehow let people down, because that's what you're supposed to do if you play the Joker, and that maybe you're not doing your job properly as an actor if you haven't let it get inside your head. I don't know what you think. Alex is a massive Batman fan. I just want to put this out there.
So
I think you've probably got some thoughts about this character in particular, and then let's move on and talk about method more in general and other examples.
Definitely. I think especially with the Joker within the comic book universe, which let's all not forget is fictitious and not real, but within that universe you've got to remember that the Joker is a standout villain, in that he was once described as his unique, I think it's actually in Arkham Asylum, possibly by Grant Morrison, and they say that his unique brand of psychosis is like trying to solve complex mathematical algorithms whilst watching 100 different TVs, all playing a different channel at the same time. Now, if you can successfully, as an actor, portray that and do that, all power to you. But good luck to you trying to do method on that, because... Yeah. It's almost an impossible hurdle, because it's such a fantastical character.
Yeah.
So I think there is a huge pitfall, especially with this particular role, that people forget how ultimately dangerous it would be to try and even replicate that.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think a lot of method that you hear about, a lot of examples that you hear about, are people trying to embody a famous real person. Mm. I know that Forest Whitaker famously went full method as Idi Amin in the film The Last King of Scotland, which I just can't imagine being his wife or kids during that time.
Must have been fun.
And I can imagine that if you're trying to get into the voice of somebody who's got a recognisable voice that people would recognise, and if you're trying to get into the character of somebody who existed, that method maybe has a place, because you are trying to get into that person to portray them accurately. But as you rightly point out, with a character that was made up in the first place, where's the artistic value in even trying to do that?
And also, what you're sort of highlighting there is more an element of practice and rehearsal. So especially with voice, if you're trying to replicate somebody's accent or exact voice themselves, like an impression, you need to be able to do that straight away.
Yeah.
And that's why a lot of people, if they're doing an accent that they're not wholly comfortable with, will want to do it
as much as possible, so
that they get used to it. Yeah. And that's I can understand. But trying to be someone the entire time so that you really do well in the performance is, for me, it's a bit of a fallacy.
Yeah, I think the way that I kind of read an article in advance just to kind of prime me for talking about this segment. And obviously a really, really famous kind of method acting anecdote is about Dustin Hoffman starring in the film Marathon Man with Laurence Olivier. And it's about, if you haven't seen it, it's a film, I think, late 70s. The guy that Dustin Hoffman plays is a long distance runner at Columbia University. And his brother is trying to track down a Nazi war criminal played by, fantastically, by Laurence Olivier, who I think was nominated for an Oscar for it. And Laurence Olivier at one point captures and tortures, I think, Dustin Hoffman's character. And he's basically like kept awake for 3 full days in the film, the character. And Dustin Hoffman famously said that in preparation for this part of the film, he himself had stayed awake partying for 3 days to get the kind of like emotional and physical exhaustion that needed to be portrayed in the film. And Laurence Olivier famously turned to him and said, "Dear boy, have you just tried acting?" Which of course is like the crux of the issue for me with method acting is if you are just making yourself into the character by putting yourself through a grueling experience or doing something that's going to mean that you perform more like them, are you really just sacrificing a part of your craft, which is to do the bit where you act?
Actually work at it.
You pretend. Yeah.
And also, how can you actually make those situations the same as what they were? Partying for a weekend is not the same as being tortured for a weekend. And so if he was really serious about it, Dustin Hoffman would have tried harder at method acting.
Yeah.
Or he could have just tried better at acting.
You could argue that one, you know, he was a young actor at the time, and I can't imagine Dustin Hoffman would try that kind of thing now at his age. You could argue that he was trying to kind of lend an element of gravitas to his performance because he was up against someone like Laurence Olivier, who had like utter kudos as an actor at that time and still does. And I think a lot of what I've read about it is that it's something that really felt like it was coming from America, and that the British acting kind of circles really kind of poo-pooed method acting as this kind of thing that Americans needed to do because they just weren't as good at acting as the British actors were, who could just get on stage and just turn it on immediately.
There might be some truth in that.
It came from Stanislavski originally in Russia, using emotional memory, which does have
Total
a useful
value,
place within the craft. And then it was brought over to America by Michael Chekhov, who's the nephew of Anton, the famous playwright. And then it was used in a lot of different colleges set up that were, Marilyn Monroe studied at, Jack Nicholson studied at. I can't remember the name, to my shame, so apologies for that. But that's where the whole method has been changed, because the Stanislavski method is to remember, draw
your emotional,
emotional toolbox, which has relevance, but to use it just all the time means... Yeah.
And to get to a point where you're not really drawing on your emotional toolbox so much as
just behaving,
just putting yourself into that that state.
And I think that's what we found from this whole Suicide Squad conversation, was that really it was the push for a story more than it was about Jared Leto? Doing actual craft of being really good at method acting. I mean, if he had done it and he had been perfect and he, you know, would have transcended Heath Ledger's Joker, then it would have been like, oh, you're a brilliant method actor. But this was really just a push for the movie to be made into a PR and marketable story.
And, you know, I think
to go
that
out and press.
There's this level of, like a level of gravitas that's associated with method acting. Like you're somehow like a more serious actor because you're prepared to make sacrifices for your craft. Like, you know, you're prepared to put yourself through a level of pain, a level of discomfort. Jared Leto talks about how he was like sequestering himself into a corner of the canteen and he couldn't sit with any of the other actors at lunch. And he sounds like
it's just because no one likes you.
He sounds like the lonely kid at high school. Like, it's so sad, you know, and it's just like, It's just like, is that suffer and sacrifice making him any more valid as an artist or a performer? Like, I'm just not convinced.
I think it makes him a different artist or performer that at the moment seems to be very en vogue.
Yeah, so, it's just popular, isn't it?
Yeah, if you want to be a good actor, you've got to live the part, as opposed to just being able to get up on stage and do it. Yeah.
For me, maybe it's my British sensibilities coming through, but for me, an actor that can just, you know, prepare themselves properly. I'm advocating the craft here. Like, you prepare yourselves properly for the role. Mm. You know, you go out and you might do your research, you might take your Stanislavski techniques, whatever. But preparing yourself for the role and then just being able to walk out on stage or walk out on set and just embody that character, like, that is a gift. That's talent. That's the craft. Mm. Not having to live it for however many weeks in the surround.
Send dead rats to your castmates.
Yeah,
I feel like your castmates would prefer if you did the first thing.
Yeah.
Your director would prefer if you walked out and did the first thing. And, you know, everyone would prefer if you didn't have the ego surrounding the fact that you were making such a huge deal about being a method actor.
And that's the thing, right? I think a lot of this maybe it wasn't to start with, but I think it has become it's become about ego. Mm. I'm a more serious actor. I'm prepared to sacrifice
more. It's a one-upmanship that is just unnecessary.
Oh, I did method for this role and it totally messed with my head. Or, you know, it's just a lot of it
method, I lost an arm.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, where does this go? And that to me doesn't feel like what acting craft really is supposed to be about.
No, definitely not.
But it's turned into a really wonderful smokescreen for the studio, who would have had quite negative reviews and all.
Yeah.
These...
Oh yeah, yeah. It's perfect for them to be able to tip the balance into something that then seems like a more serious.
And as a PR vehicle, that's fantastic, because you go, I wonder how much this actually happened, or if just because their ratings are so bad at the moment, like, they had to make some kind of story to make this movie sell.
There was actually one time where Jared Leto had a bit of a cold, so he sat in the corner of the canteen and they just made like a whole thing out of it.
He didn't actually go that method. Oh, bless him. Well, yeah, thanks Vix for that. That was I was really impressed, Alex, as well, with your method history. That was that was uncalled for.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for that.
Here are we.
It's a learning experience.
Yeah, we know stuff.
Yeah.
Turns out.
I have one question about method. Like, is there a spectrum of method, or is it just like, do some people go full method and then? And like, by full method, I mean like, take it home to your family, do it on the weekends with your mates. Like, can you imagine knowing someone like that?
So method has different types and interpretations of what people really mean by method. So Dustin Hoffman's version of method was to prepare himself for one particular event by actually making himself in that level of discomfort.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't being the character that he was playing in the film the whole time, but to prepare for that particular scene, he did something physical. So it's like, if you can imagine, you're going on stage and you're supposed to be out of breath because you've just run 100 metres really fast.
Oh,
if you're just faking that by walking out on stage, it would actually be kind of difficult. The best thing to do would be to run up and down really fast backstage and then run out onto stage, and you would genuinely be panting.
Yes.
Right? So in a way, that's like a tiny little bit of method. Like, that's like the smallest increment of method you could do.
Mm-hmm.
And then the end spectrum is Forrest Whitaker being literally living and breathing Idiot Amin for every single day of shooting, where he's not just doing the voice, but he is apparently being the character as well, which must have made him incredibly difficult to work with.
That's not fun for anyone. That was just my question at the end of that. Thank you for confirming that, Vicky.
No problem.
So the next thing that we're going to do is something that none of us in the studio currently have heard yet. So this is Matt, our roving reporter in Edinburgh, and he's going to be talking about shows that he's seen.
I think so.
I think he's going to be reviewing. He's going to be with his friend Amy, I believe.
Yes, Amy is a fantastic reviewer. She's done loads of reviewing. She's been to Edinburgh every year I've known her, which is quite a long time.
Mm.
And she has great and interesting things to say about all walks of theatre. So I'm sure it'll be excellent.
This is Matt and Amy.
This is Matt at the Edinburgh Fringe. And I've grabbed Amy Yorston, friend of Blackshaw, regular Fringe goer and... British Theatre Guide reviewer in a small gap in her very busy schedule. Hello.
Hello, thank you for having me.
So just how busy is your schedule, given that you're reviewing and seeing shows for pleasure?
So I'm averaging this year, I said I was going to take it easy, but I haven't, between 5 and 8 shows a day. So yesterday was an 8 show day, but I was only reviewing 3 of them, so most of them were just for pleasure. So I'm doing a bit of a 50-50 balance, that's the aim.
Okay, so does that mean all your gaps between shows are for writing them up?
Basically, yes. I'm permanently in debt to myself by 1 or 2 reviews, just on a treadmill of trying to get them out there. Because obviously the companies want them as quickly as you can, but you have to think about it, to what you actually want to say that's going to reflect it well. So, yes, my brain's whizzing. So often I can't remember what I've just seen, which isn't great.
It's fringe brain.
Fringe brain.
Fringe brain is a real and present risk
yes.
to all at this festival.
Particularly midway through the week, as we are currently. But no one has fringe flu this year, which is good. Maybe it's because we've
Fingers
come towards
crossed,
the end. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I've definitely been had moments where it's been about sort of 5 or 6 in the afternoon and somebody's asked me, what have you seen today? And I know I've seen 3 shows and I can't remember what any of them were.
Yes, or where they were.
Yeah. Where have I been? I don't know. I remember very clearly a show I saw 2 days ago.
Yes, and I haven't eaten yet, so...
Yeah, we were saying earlier, we don't really name meals anymore.
No, gone past that point.
It's not a lunch break, it's just a food break.
Yes, it's a pit stop for energy and coffee and lots of tea.
Yeah. So is there any, is there a difference between the shows that you're booking to see just for pleasure while you're up here and the shows that you're booking to review?
Shamefully, yes.
Because you get to choose what you go and review for the British Theatre.
Yes, so how we work it, all publications do it differently, is that we have a master spreadsheet. So we put in, go through the brochure as quickly as we can and put in what we'd really like to see. And then our editor creates a massive master sheet and makes sure that he allocates it all out so we're not crossing over and bothering press offices by all requesting the same thing. So because of that, it's quite tricky. I try and make sure I see things that are slightly out of my comfort zone for a reviewing purpose, just to see something different and also to make sure I'm challenging myself. Although I've done that a lot this year, which is why I'm being a bit slower to type them up. So as a writer, I'm challenging myself a bit, rather than just seeing the same theatre companies who I love and I know I'm going to enjoy it and I know it's going to be amazing, which is fantastic but a little bit lazy. And they're often the companies that get the most praise anyway, so it's good to see new stuff. So yes, I would say most of my reviewing is more serious dramatic theatre, and most of my evening stuff is fun cabaret comedy styly.
Okay, so on that note, what have you seen that's been really out of your comfort zone that you've had a real problem like working out how to write about?
So far I would say Beyond Price at Summer Hall. We've had several discussions about this one. And I almost feel like I need to review it again and see it again to get enough out of it. Partially because the brochure description didn't match up with what the performance actually was, which didn't help. I thought I was going to see a comedy. And it was funny, but it was more of a lecture on the value of art. But he packs a huge amount into the hour. And as I say, part lecture, part theatrical, part his own musings on life. Part of him talking about programming the venue, there was so much information to take in and then process it and try to write it out quickly. It was quite a tricky one, but I did really enjoy it.
Because it sounds like it could be, because it's the guy who programmed Summer Hall.
Yes.
Doing a solo show at Summer Hall. It sounds like it could be a little bit of a vanity project.
Yes, and I think it probably is. But he does it with so much heart and enthusiasm, you just can't help but buy into it. And he talks about all the things that they nearly booked and they tried to book and things that couldn't afford to tour. So it's a sort of a tantalizing, oh, they nearly saw that, maybe next year. But yeah, it probably is a fantasy project, but it's done so well it sort of doesn't matter too much.
So it sort of stretches you because you're expecting theater and you get a lecture.
Yes,
you can't really use the same sort of reviewing vocabulary.
No.
To review academia,
and
almost.
Also, which I did actually put a line in the review about, he's talking about the value of art. So the very fact that I am reviewing it, what does that say about it? What does that say about me as a reviewer? What's that say about why we need to even review it at all? Which is obviously slightly more an academic approach. So I've only included a one-liner on that. That's more of an essay topic. But yes, discussing the value of art and then sitting there sort of judging it, for want of a better expression, is an uneasy relationship, I think.
I mean, talking of Summer Hall, Summer Hall's kind of a theme of this year's Fringe, at least for us.
Yeah.
Their programme is just really stunning this year.
It's beautifully done. And their themes, for anything I've seen so far anyway, seems to be identity and building projects and building art and making things and reflecting on how things come to be. So if anybody's got any time, I'd say check out their... I might just only go to Summer Hall shows next year.
You're at Summer Hall pretty much all day today.
Yes. Yeah, I'm back to back at Summer Hall today. So what have we got? We've got Castle Builder, which I've just seen, 100 Homes, and then All In, which is gig, theatre. It's one of those descriptions where I think it's a bit of everything.
There's a few of those around this year as well. Things describing themselves as part show, part gig.
Yes.
Which is, I kind of feel, is a bit of a way out of calling it a musical.
Definitely.
I saw one last night, Torch at the Underbelly, which describes itself as part gig, which is, it's a one-woman show, and occasionally she stops at regular intervals to sing relevant verses and choruses of pop songs. So you could describe that as a musical.
Mm.
It would not be inaccurate. But calling it part gig gives you a bit of a different kind of, it gives the audience a slightly different relationship with the show.
Yes, and an expectation, I think, as well, because unfortunately musical theatre still has that sort of jazz hands image, whereas music theatre doesn't. So by saying it's a gig, I think you get that extra excitement of, oh, maybe I can stand up and join in and
clap and cheer.
Yeah, get involved. It's a bit more immersive. I think there's a lot more audience participation this year from everything I've been to. Either the traditional come up on stage and join us, or sort of the immersive approach. There's lots of those. I haven't caught Early Doors yet, but I'm hearing fantastic things. That's set in a pub. So as you're going in, the staff are actually serving you the drinks behind the bar, and then it transpires they're the actors. And yeah, most, bar one, I think all shows I've been in so far, I've had some element of participation going on. In a friendly way, thankfully. I've not seen anything horrendously awkward yet.
It's quite a fringe.
It hasn't finished.
we'll have to do a tweet update.
Yeah.
Followers on Blackshore update. So not too much site-specific stuff this year, I've noticed. So there is that one, Early Doors, in the pub. There's something else that's on a bus that you have to get on a bus at the Assembly Gardens, and it goes round the city while people like dance on the bus, swinging themselves around the poles, those sorts of things.
Wrecked, which a friend of mine has just seen, is in a car.
Okay.
So obviously very limited audience for that one. So I think they're doing four shows a day because they can only fit three people in at a time. but yeah, fewer grandiose products, I think, like that. I haven't spotted anything. I saw The Tempest on a boat a few years ago out in Leith, and I haven't spotted anything like that so far.
So lots of audience participation, which it strikes me as a very fringe thing.
Mm.
It's sort of, you get a higher percentage of shows with that up here than really anywhere else, I think.
I think, yeah, you can't come to a fringe show and sit in the front row and not expect to be picked on somehow, even if it's just an intense amount of eye contact. Like it's going to happen.
I certainly had that at another Summer Hall show yesterday. So one of the things with Summer Hall is it's an academic venue and it's got a lot of really, really interesting spaces in it. So this one was in the Anatomy Lecture Theatre. So it's set up like one of those Victorian lecture theatres with this really steep rake, everybody in a semicircle, which was a one-woman show about sort of representation of women's bodies in the media. Wow. And there was lots of walking around. She climbed on the seats quite a bit. There was a lot of passing things out to people on the front row. She passed it all out, cocktails called a leg spreader.
Wow.
While making intense, creepy eye contact.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is audience participation on your fringe bingo card?
Definitely.
You have one of those.
I do totally have a fringe bingo card. I have treat shows. So David O'Doherty is my treat comedian. I can't do fringe without him. But he actually, funnily enough, doesn't do audience participation. But yes, Shitface Shakespeare have a lovely amount of it. I think they're quite safe. You can go to
they're
one of their shows
of
and be like, I might get picked on, but I'm probably not going to mind.
Yeah.
So
that's the show where they do a stripped down production of a Shakespeare play, and each night a different member of the cast is drunk.
Yes.
Having spent 4 hours before the show steadily drinking.
And really drunk, not just slightly tipsy. They really go with the title. having seen it a few times now, the first time I was dubious, I thought maybe it was just brilliant acting, but no, it's all out. And then I do love as well Showstoppers Improvised Musical, who do literally that. So they ask for audience suggestions for location and styles of music. So again, they're a very safe pair of I might end up joining in, but I'm not going to make a fool of myself because they only want good suggestions. So the one I saw the other night was set inside a snow globe.
Ooh.
Which even for them, it was a setting that they'd not done before, so they were quite excited.
Pretty left field.
It was very left field.
I guess the audience is... Oh, we're aware of them enough now that they turn up with some pre-prepared out-of-the-way suggestions.
There was a lot of people suggesting Corbyn's campaign committee and trying to get very political, but Snow Globe won the audience vote with an audience-suggested title of The Snow Way Out.
Beautiful.
So it was a musical about self-discovery and physically getting out of a snow globe, which was a beautiful thing. So yes, good fun participation.
I should say that the show I mentioned at Summer Hall is called If There's Not Dancing at the Revolution, I'm Not Coming, if anybody fancies the sound of that. So very enthusiastic about lots of shows so far.
Mm.
Is it not the fringe until you've seen something rubbish?
Yes. I've not seen anything rubbish yet. I think I don't know if I'm just getting better at picking them. This is my ninth fringe now. So reading the press releases, you get a bit of a vibe. So I don't know if I'm just getting better at not picking awful things. But I'm slightly worried that it's nearly the end of the week and I haven't seen anything truly dreadful. Because you just have to. And that makes you appreciate how good the good stuff is.
Can I recommend Petrol at the Zoo? Which I don't think they'll mind me naming them because they did come up at the end and say... if you didn't enjoy this, please tell us about it anyway, because one audience is as good as another.
All publicity is good publicity.
Yeah, so that was a piece of dark clowning by a pair of people in welding masks, which I found kind of...
Very fringe.
Very fringe. It sounded good. I've seen lots of really good stuff at the zoo before, and lots of... It's particularly really good dark clowning pieces at the zoo before. So I felt like I was in quite safe hands, but it was kind of boring.
Oh.
And that is kind of the cardinal sin of clowning, I think.
Yes. And definitely the cardinal sin of the fringe, where most shows aren't more than an hour anyway.
Yeah.
So if you get bored within the hour, that's not a good sign.
We did have a conversation the other night about our sort of bored or not enjoying it reactions.
That's yes.
How you can tell when people in the audience are just not into it.
Yes. Squirming, shifting, sighing.
Punching, covering the face.
Yeah. I adopt a quizzical expression for getting bored, because often I am quite near the front, because some of the venues, there are slightly restrictive views, so if I'm reviewing it, I do want to be able to see everything. So I'm very conscious of my bored face and try and hide it by adopting a sort of semi, I'm considering what you're performing. I try to look engaged. But I did sit next to someone this morning who, contrary to me, was clearly not enjoying the show and did sigh and tuck their whole way through it. Ooh. Very loudly.
Oh, audibly not into
audibly
it.
Audibly not into it. They'd probably have been better off just leaving, to be honest. but they were very lucky they didn't get picked on, I thought. So that was quite kind of the performers, because it was the sort of show where they could have been and they chose not to.
So other than Summer Hall being great, have you noticed, so this is your ninth fringe, you're a veteran.
Go from the 10th year, my anniversary next year.
Have you noticed, are there any sort of patterns that you've noticed of stuff that there's kind of more of this year than there have been in other years? Is there kind of a mood?
I think the mood seems to be lots of identity questions. Even some of the comedies I've seen have been questioning self-image and self-branding. I mean, there's always shows that lean that way, but nearly every single show I've seen has been on that theme. And sort of the be true to yourself, but what does that mean? And I don't know if that is the theatrical world reacting to cuts and budgets changing and, you know, the whole setup of touring venues and life changing, or if it's a political reaction to everything else that's going on in the whole of Europe, or whether it is just we're at a crux of sort of 2016, a lot of people are, who might have been student theatre companies and now a bit older and questioning what they're up to and what their careers are. But that seems to be, for me anyway, the theme that's come through quite strongly.
I've just seen a piece in a shipping container at Assembly about Britishness, what that means. There's a lot of shows seem to be sort of on that same line, describing themselves, at least in their sort of catalogue descriptions, as punk or... resurrecting the spirit of punk,
yes,
or that kind of feel. Not huge. I've seen a couple of the ones that describe themselves that way. Not all of them quite as sort of genuinely anarchic as I would hope from a show describing itself as punk.
I think that's the tricky thing. The lady I sat next to on the train on the way up here was talking about being a proper veteran of the Fringe. She's not like 30 years worth. And that spirit, she was saying how amazing a lot of the pieces are nowadays. But because it's got into that factory and all the venues are so big, that the anarchic spirit of the Fringe, she thought, was getting a bit commercialised and a bit health and safety orientated, and
yeah,
can't stand there, can't have audience in the aisles, you can't do this, which is good for us as audience members if we're safe. But she was saying when she first came, it was truly a lot of it quite ramshackle, and
yeah,
you stumbled across things a lot better because the publicity wasn't out, you didn't have social media, all of that side of it. So for her, the Fringe is getting a bit safe, which is quite an interesting reflection, I thought.
I kind of agree with that. I've seen a few things that are sort of, they're punk in message, but not necessarily in form. They're still like, this is a piece of naturalistic theatre.
Yeah.
Maybe with a few songs scattered through it.
And we can't afford to smash a television set because we're here for the whole month. But I think as well, there's quite a few shows that are self-referencing millennials and what we want. I suppose I'm also one. And contrasting that, Happy Dave at Pleasance is all about a guy who wants to recapture his raving days in the 90s and gets his office involved, and they set up legal raves and try and recapture that. And his point throughout the play is he had to strive for something because there weren't any possibilities and weren't any opportunities. And he reflects that today there's too many opportunities and there's a jungle, so the expectations are very, very high.
Yeah.
And that's come through in quite a few of them as well. I think people are quite self-reflective from that point.
Okay. Now, something happened this Fringe that I've never heard of happening before. When you went to book all your press tickets for the shows that you decided to get.
Yes. Every brilliant thing didn't want me.
So this is the Payne's Plough show, the long-running Payne's Plough show, Every Brilliant Thing. What was their reason for refusing a press ticket?
Well, the reason I was given that basically they're sold out, so they feel that if any seats come up, that really it should go to audience. But essentially, it's been so successful. They didn't say this directly, but I read between the lines as we don't really need any more reviews because everything they've had has been so fantastic, and they've toured it and they were here last year. So yes, I wasn't wanted in the nicest possible way. In the nicest possible way.
So there is such a thing as enough or too much press.
Yeah, and we found that limit now.
So before I let you go and let you get back to your summer hall programme of the day, what have you got left booked in that you're really looking forward to and hoping will be good?
Various things. From a reviewing point of view, I'm quite excited about We Are Ian, which is tonight, talking about anarchic and punk. This is described as basically Ian was alive in the 80s and we've stolen his music. Here we go. I'm just really intrigued to see what they do with it, and really intrigued how to process it and how I'm going to write up something. As you say, if genres keep blending, the vocabulary is going to have to change. Margaret Thatcher, Queen of Soho, I gave 5 stars to last year. She's back with Margaret Thatcher, Queen of Game Shows. I'm not reviewing it, but I've booked it just on the basis that I'm expecting it to be a lot of fun. And I've got Trainspotting booked in as well, which I think should be fantastic. That's all sold out. And the buzz about that has been amazing. So, yes. But that's my final show, so I've got a little gap Thursday night where I want to find something to really finish on a high rather than a depressing, drug-addled storyline.
Okay. Where can people find or follow you online if they are interested in finding your reviews and things?
I'm on Twitter. I'm quite easy to find because I'm Amy the Yorston. As far as I know, there's only one of me. But you can find all my reviews at britishtheatreguide.info. And the whole team, there's been loads of us up here this year covering everything, including the International Festival. So check out the whole range from just mine.
Right. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you.
So that was Matt and Amy talking about some of the stuff that they've been seeing up at the Edinburgh Fringe at the moment. So, yeah, they've been having a great time. Dicks?
Why wouldn't they be? I am so jealous. I am never having a fringeless summer again.
Really?
Yeah, but never do it. It's been pretty upsetting.
Okay.
Dave's face is like...
You don't have to come. I will go without you. I love the fringe. I love it.
Well, Dave, you're going to have to do something else next summer. Vicky and I will go to the fringe, it would appear.
Make it happen.
The next thing that we're going to move into is a new writing piece. This is called Trim. It was written by James Barry, and Ellie Pitkin actually directed it, and it's being performed by Charlotte Worthing. This was recorded at the Horse and Stables at our May New Writing Night of this year.
It's not that I don't like being close to people. S-E-X, but everything I do. I once had a very intimate affair with the postman. We almost touched. It took place in the early weeks of spring, starting on Monday the 17th of March, 2014. I remember the date because it rained endlessly and letters came through my post slit, slightly soggy, but forcefully, brazenly. Right away I thought, well, hello saucy. This has got potential. One thing led to another, and soon I was pressed up against my door every other morning, waiting for his sullen tread up my path to post things. I never saw his face, though I did think about it. I thought I might order something bulky that he'd have to knock for. That seemed to be getting too serious too quickly, and I don't like to be tied down like that. Well, could be persuaded, but that's a whole other thing involving packing tape and brown paper packages, and that conjured up images of Julie Andrews and singing Nazis, so I thought best not. In any case, it involves more face-to-face contact than I usually like. I prefer to keep things casual. I'm a modern woman, after all. I just take the whole anonymous sex thing a little further than most. I knew it was a short-lived thing. He was a bit of a tease, to be honest. Found that one out the hard way. I was lying, face up, under the letterbox, waiting for the post to explode out, cascade down onto me, the usual way. He was started with the flyers. That was our foreplay. Flyers and coupons. It's so erotic to feel the cheap plastic paper and read, buy one, get one free from Pizza Hut. As it flutters lightly down through your door onto your skin. Honestly, you'd be surprised. Try it sometime. Anyway, then comes the heavier stuff. Tesco vouchers, junk mail I've ordered, introductory offers. But he started to hold back, drop them in one at a time. Like he knew I was there and he was playing with me. I almost screamed. I want a downpour of correspondence, a deluge of dailies to the face, and all I'm getting is a steady stream of circulars, one after the other. I mean, I know it happens to 4 out of 5 posties at some point in their lives, but still. Then comes the worst. Instead of an outpouring of bank statements, credit card applications, and to the occupiers, more than enough to RSVP my brains out, it all gets jammed in one lump. In, wait for it, an elastic band. Well, that's just not the sort of thing I stand for in a partner, no matter how good the paper cuts feel. Not sure if he heard me when I said it was over, when I yelled it at the door that night. He probably wasn't there anymore. 9 hours later. I don't go outside that much, so how was I to know either way? I still get a warm feeling whenever the post is delivered. But it's a new guy now, I think. The other one must have quit. Heartbroken, no doubt. Like I say, I'm really very normal in the relationship stakes. You've got to keep things in perspective when you work at home, day in, day out. You don't want to turn into a nutcase or shut in. I go out and about every now and again. Mostly to get the essentials, food, writing pads, proofs from my boss. Not out, of course. There's a receiving box outside my door for food, and there's such a thing as a cardo, you know. We're not living in the dark ages. Unless you use Tesco Online. Because they make you sign for everything, and I'm a firm believer like being independent and standing on my own 2 feet. Preferably at least 2 feet away from anyone else standing on theirs. There are exceptions, though. Everyone has exceptions. Let's get this straight from the off. I'm not agoraphobic. I just don't like being outside where there are big dogs. It's understandable, right? I mean, they can be really, really vicious, big dogs. So can medium-sized dogs. Well, or small dogs. Any dog, frankly. Or cats, stoats, weasels, mice, rats, squirrels, which are basically rats with good PR anyway, rabbits, horses, sheep, Jersey but not Frisian cows, rabid badgers, midget giraffes, curious monkeys of any kind, and, as is only sensible, goldfish. Birds I can take or leave. Humans as well. They should be on the list. A big part of the list. Most of the list, really. I should come clean. I actually quite like dogs. And the rest. Apart from the goldfish. They can fuck off. It's more the people I have a problem with, which is odd, because I like people. Not them themselves, as it were. They always make me feel uncomfortable. Like I'm not worth it. I try to speak up at parties, but I always get the feeling that no one really cares, and then they speak over me and I just fade into the background. That's always been my experience. It's been a while since I went to a party, but I'm sure it'll be the same now. Spice Girls blaring out the radio, sneaking alcohol, illicit fags smoked on my own, leant out of a window, trying not to set the curtains on fire, all fall 2 stories to the garden below, failing at both and passing out from the pain before being found by the firemen on their way to put out the blaze. I was the life and soul. It may have been a long while since I've been to a party, but it's probably all the same in essence. I do miss it, though. Not the people, as such, per se. Not so much actual people, but the contact. Which is where the wigs come in. Now, I know it seems like 80-plus wigs may seem excessive, bordering on compulsive, some might say reclusive, fetishistic even. I prefer to be known, if I am, as a connoisseur. And it's not as if I collect them, anyway, not for themselves. They're all the same. Short, brown, with a fringe. Very realistic, though, aren't they? They have to be. Otherwise, people look at you oddly when you get them cut. I found that out the hard way. Went in for a trim with a long black number once. The hairdresser took one look at me and said, "You're having a laugh, hun." And I beat a hasty retreat, never to go back there again. Defeated the whole point. Which is the contact, as I said. I learned fairly quickly in life that people are annoying, boring, stuck up, and downright mean. But I miss the feeling, the touch. And for that, there's nothing like a good hair appointment. Think about it. You can be anyone. Tell any story you like. They don't care. Half the time they go on about the weather, or your jobs, or holiday. But that's not important. It's all fake. The real thing is the closeness. There are many ways to achieve this, but a cut is the best. I've tried them all, you see. Going to the doctor's ends up with a note on your file for hypochondria, as if an appointment every other day was too much or something. Plus, you have to keep making up things to sound both plausible and mean they'll actually get close to you. Another learning experience. Don't WebMD a disease without finding out how contagious it is. Unless you want to close down a whole GP's office and be quarantined for a few days. Which is the opposite of what we're going for here. You can try specialities, of course. Opticians, podiatrists, chiropractors, dermatologists, proctologists, you name it. But that leaves you with the same lack of contact week on week, as well as a cupboard full of unused lenses, insoles, corrective braces, lotions and moisturisers, and frankly, it's all a pain in the arse. But faking the symptoms is more trouble than it's worth, and far too cold and medical. Where are all the unprofessional medical professionals these days? Even the gynecologist was clinical. For something so personal, it was too impersonal. Dentist was the same. They have the closeness, but they're too aloof. Like they've seen all the mysteries of the human soul through the molar. Worse, I've always been cursed with perfect teeth, so that's out. I did try the tube at one point. If there's anywhere you can feel the salt of the earth crammed up against you without anyone saying anything, it's the Victoria line between Bond Street and Vauxhall at 5:30 on a Friday night. But you do get odd looks, and it tends to be a little too salty. Added to the fact that I like things more intimate, one-on-one. I'm seem like a devil may care, anything goes, ready for a good time person, but I'm not about to let a whole carriage full of complete strangers commute all over me. Once was more than enough. It's off the bucket list. But wasn't my kind of thing. There's adventurous and then there's that. No, trust me. A good haircut is the way forward. Picture it. You settle in. Comfortable chair, worn around and indented by so many others that you feel welcome already. If you're feeling risque, you can even go to the older salon with leather seats. Save that for special occasions. They approach, black, bib-like cloak in hand, ready to tuck you up, safety pin you in, take your order. You can have anything you like. If you only want a little off the bottom, they can trim away. That's fine for some, but I'm there for the real goods. They'll wash your hair, massaging guava and hazelnut essence putty into the scalp. They'll rub you right down to the root with wicker bark and sandstone pumice. They'll scrape the ends with lychee and truffle soothing balm, or maybe scent your follicles with deep cleansing arugula and onion coulis. But it's all preamble. Build up and pay off. It's the sexy bit before the real fun. Everyone knows the best part is the bit after, when you're all clean and done, slightly damp, but satisfied. Then comes the part I really like. Because when all the washing and scenting and combing is done, you sit in that chair and they cut your hair. Think about it. Really stop and think. This person, who you don't really know at all, is entrusted with your body, your life. I mean, not literally, unless something goes really badly with the clippers. But they're a breath away from you, a heartbeat. They move around you like a comforting partner, hugging your back with their chest as they lean forward to do the top, brushing your hair behind the ear as they trim, coming eye to eye and mouth to mouth with you as they utter the sultry, loving words, "Close your eyes," while they trim the fringe. It's like nothing else. The experience is so personal, so confidential. They are right there and you're right there in front of them. They affect how you look, how you feel, how you think about yourself and others. In that moment, there's nothing to compare with how personal that is to me. Is there honestly anything more intimate in the world? So that's where I go. Different salons, almost every day. I got really good at weaving the wigs into my hair, so few of the hairdressers can even tell. If they do, they don't let on. They may have nothing to say, but they're a good lot. I told you, it's not that I don't like people, or that I don't go out. I do. It's not that I don't like getting close to people. I do. It's the closest two people can ever really get. I know that.
You were just listening to Trim, written by James Barry and performed by Charlotte Worthing. We have a new writing night coming up in September.
That is correct. It is on Monday, the 19th of September. It is going to be at our brand spanking new venue. Well, we've been there once before, but we're still excited about the fact that it's new.
I haven't been there before.
You haven't been there before. It's new for Aisha. That's all that counts. It is at the Hen and Chickens in Highbury and Islington. It is right over the road from the station. So it's a little way from Wandsworth, but it is worth the trip.
Yeah. Did you say you're going to be...
I may well be performing.
Are you making it?
No, direct it. You're directing.
I'm directing?
Yes, that's what I told you.
Oh. I thought I was performing.
No, you're directing.
Oh, right.
Have
okay.
you done that before?
Alex is a man of many talents. He can direct
I've directed one new writing night piece before,
that's
so
why
this
I
will
asked
be my second.
Ah. Yeah.
There we go. Cracking. Come along yeah, just for that.
Hell
just for
yeah.
the surprises of the night.
It's not a surprise. I literally told him.
Keep up, mate. Come
on. Read your WhatsApp messages, dude.
Well, with that is the end of the show for another week. Thank you, Dave, for your very first appearance on the show.
No problem. Anytime.
A little bit of a baptism of fire because you just happened to be here.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I'm never coming here again.
He's joking, people. He's joking.
He'll be back.
We're going to get him back to do Arts Thing of the Week about computer games.
Yeah.
Do that.
We've been talking about this off air, obviously, because we've never said it on the radio, but
until I just said it just now.
Yeah.
And there we go. That's now, I have no choice other than to do it because it's been said live on Rare. It is now done.
I've committed. Yeah.
Correct. Sorry, Dave.
No worries. I'll start thinking.
The full team will be back on the next show. Matt will be back from Edinburgh. He'll be doing a movie, which I am not aware of yet, but I'm sure it'll be...
How is he fitting that in? Like, how is he doing it?
He's a man of many talents.
He is a man of many talents.
Yeah, it'll probably be...
Scheduling, if nothing else.
Yeah.
Oh, actually, no, I think I might know what he's doing. You know, the sausage party.
Oh, is it?
Might be sausage party.
Oh, my God.
Wow. If you don't know what we're talking about,
for the love of God, look
I'm
it up.
Very sorry. The Sausage Party is a movie coming out starring Seth Rogen, and it's animated. And it's sausages talking, obviously. So
Salma Hayek's in it as well.
All the good people are in it.
Pretty much everyone is in it. It's got like a 40-person long cast list. It's
really?
Yeah, it's humongous.
He's got the draw, you know. Like, Seth can get the people.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
He for sure can.
Especially when you're casting people as sausages. I mean, who wouldn't want to play a
sausage? I would 100% sign up for that movie.
Of course. And with that, that's the end of the show. So thanks, Alex. Thanks, Vix. And Dave will be with you in a fortnight's time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.